Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yo, welcome into the House of L podcast. I'm Lawrence. Thanks so much for listening to the episode today. It's really strange, you know, no matter what you end up doing in your career, if your family members think it's cool, there's always something about what it is you do that they probably think is cooler than what you do. I'll give you a perfect example, and it has to do with our guest today. So obviously, I know Mitch Albom from being an award-winning sports reporter. And so that's usually how I think of him first. And I've had the chance to actually work with him a little bit on the Sports Reporters podcast, which I'll get to in a minute. But it's so funny to me how the context of conversations changes from person to person. My parents obviously listen to my podcast. They are very supportive in that. And they know that I do these sports-a-roo and they get into it. My father's watching Alabama games now. And my mom is always asking about what's going on with the Bears and all of that stuff. My parents are academics. So I have always thought that they're humoring me. Like, they want me to succeed, so they're taking an interest in the things that I like. We have a lot of great conversations about teaching because, you know, they're both teachers. But when it comes to this stuff, you recognize how big the world is when you have a guest like Mitch on the show. And you recognize that not everything should be viewed through the prism of the old sports-a-roo. There has been no guest, and I mean no guest, on my podcast that my mother was more excited to hear from than Mitch Albom. And look, I understand he's an award-winning writer and movie producer. But it's so weird to me. She said to me when I was at my parents' house and I told her that this episode was coming up, she goes, "Oh, wow, the author?" I said, "Yeah." She's like, "How do you know him?" And I was like, "He's a legendary sports guy." She had no idea. That's how interesting the world is, and it lets you know the type of reach that Mitch Albom has. Here I am looking at it through the prism of, yeah, when you think about Detroit sports, you think about Mitch Albom, you think about the sports reporters, you think about him revolutionizing, being a part of revolutionizing opinion people being on TV and that being profitable, which is something that we end up talking about here inside the episode. But it gives you an idea of how well-known and well-liked he is, how famous he actually is. Like, that's a weird thing. Like, I've got Mitch Albom's phone number. And now, like, seeing how big of a deal it is to my mom, I'm like, oh. It's just crazy. Like, it's really weird. Like, I was super excited to share this with you for a lot of reasons. One, because Mitch is actually on the podcast, and we talk about the industry and how the industry has changed. And you know me, like, I love those types of conversations. We also get into his book, which I will talk about in a second, because it's a really amazing book. But to see my mom, like, light up knowing that I was talking with Mitch Albom was really, really cool. So Mitch wrote a book. The book is called The Stranger in the Lifeboat. It's a novel, okay? And he sent it out to me. I was so happy to get it. I knew that I had the interview coming up, and I devoured this book. I absolutely devoured it. I was trying to get ready for the interview, but I also just found myself, because, you know, sometimes what happens is if you get a book sent to you by an author, they'll give you cliff notes. Here are some things that you could ask Mitch Albom about the book. In case the person who's doing the interview can't finish the book or doesn't have time, this happens a lot. You'd be surprised of how many interviews about a book the interviewer hasn't read. It's one of the things I really respect about Jon Stewart and John Oliver and Trevor Noah. Like, they try really hard to make sure that if they have an author on, that they understand the book that the author is presenting. And so I try to follow that model if I have an author on to discuss their book. Mitch has done everything when it comes to writing that you can do. Like, he has a New York Times bestseller. Tuesdays with Maury was huge. It was just huge. And so now there's this book, and it's called The Stranger in the Lifeboat. I don't know how you feel about books in this day and age. A lot of people like the visual instead of reading it. And if they do turn this into a movie or a series somewhere, I will be interested in how they make it look, because it's very vividly written. I was able to put myself on the sea and on the boat. I don't want to give too much away about the book, because I do want you to get it. And again, the name of the book is called The Stranger in the Lifeboat. But basically, this book is about our struggles with faith and the power of faith, told in a very compelling story. And I'm telling you, you're going to get it, and you're going to look, and you're going to be like, Lawrence, this book is 275 pages. It is. And once you open it up, you're not going to be able to stop reading it. So I talked with Mitch about his book and the storytelling process that he had in putting this book together. We also talked about his career and what it is to go from being a sports columnist to being a world-renowned novelist, to win awards, to see your words pop up on the big screen and movies and all sorts of stuff. The other thing that I think is really interesting about Mitch is the way that he loves Detroit. And I'm glad that he was so open in talking about it. What he's doing with the Say Detroit umbrella, he's one of the people in Detroit that's trying to make a difference. And as I tell him inside of here, when I was in Detroit, I actually went to one of the places that ends up being a really, really good change agent inside of Detroit, and it's through the Say Detroit umbrella. The other thing that I think is amazing about Mitch is him running an orphanage in Haiti. Do you know, like, and he tells the backstory to this, which I'm fascinated by. I'm fascinated by how he is driven to do good and the lengths to which he will go to try and do good. Because it's not easy to run an orphanage. It's definitely not easy to run an orphanage in another country. And he will tell you about how all of that came to be with the Half Faith Haiti orphanage. And if you're looking for a good place to give some of your discretionary income to, if you're like, man, I'd really like to find someone who's out here trying to do good, the Have Faith Haiti Orphanage in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Consider them as you're considering places to donate before the year is over. So we talk about the book, and we talk about broadcasting. We talk about journalism. I kind of needed, quite honestly, to have a conversation with someone like him to work some things through that I'm thinking about now from a work standpoint. So it was great to bend his ear a little bit and discuss how the industry changes and what changes are good and what changes are not so good. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation, and I really think you're going to enjoy the book, The Stranger in the Lifeboat. Me and Mitch Albom talking about his book, broadcasting, life, Haiti, Detroit, all of that. But we started off with him being kind about my appearances on the Sports Reporters podcast.
Once a sports reporter, always a sports reporter. It's like the Musketeers.
That's right. That is right. There's so much I want to talk to you about when it comes to the book and everything. But first, I wanted to tell you that the first baseball trip that I took in this kind of midway or hopefully post-pandemic life was Detroit. I went to go see the White Sox play in Detroit. I had a wonderful time. I stayed in downtown Detroit, and I was able to go into the water ice store.
Oh, okay.
And it was awesome, and I was like, I totally forgot that this was something that you were a big part of and that, say, Detroit was a big part of.
Yeah, we created that shop, and it's just going strong, and everything that we sell in there, all the money goes to our charitable organization, Say Detroit. But the food is great. The water ice is top-notch, and the soft serve was voted the best in Michigan, and now we serve gourmet popcorn that we make, all these crazy flavors. And yeah, it's very interesting to have a retail business that does good. You know, we're able to say, well, there's no calories in this stuff because you can't gain weight when you're doing good, you know. And so a lot of people go, oh, in that case, I'll have a large. So it works.
Well, it's just cool to see you talk about Detroit the way that I talk about the South Side of Chicago. And I want to know, like, where does that come from? Like, where does that kind of civic love for Detroit come from?
Well, to be honest, it came like the first day or two I got here, and that was in 1985. I come to be the sports columnist for the Detroit Free Press, and they had written a little story about me, but I hadn't started writing yet. And I came to the office just to kind of meet people, and they said, oh, you got some mail. How can I get mail? I haven't written anything. Who did I tick off already? There was a letter amongst the mail that I got from this older couple, it seemed like, and they wrote this beautiful little welcoming note, and they said, well, we just wanted to say hello and welcome to Detroit. We saw the story about you, and we hope that you're going to enjoy it here. We know you won't stay long because none of the good ones do. But while you're here, we hope that you enjoy your time. And I read that. I said, wow, they're already figuring like I'm going to leave. And I haven't even started yet. And I found that was true the longer I stayed here. Like, there was a bit of an inferiority complex. Like, you know, people come to Detroit and then they ricochet out and go to a bigger market or something else like that. And I don't know, I just kind of aligned with that. I guess maybe something in my youth, I just sort of felt like an underdog or whatever. And I just sort of fell in love with the place from that first letter and have have been in love with it ever since. I love the people here. I love the attitude here. It's despite everything, I mean, we take so many hits on the chin and so many knocks on a national basis. And it's not so bad now, but certainly 20, 30 years ago, people called Detroit the armpit of America. And, we had Devil's Night every night, and they would send national news crews in to film the fires that started and say, see, there's Detroit still burning. You kind of take it personally after a while, and I'm sure with the South Side of Chicago, same kind of thing. And so when opportunities came to leave, and I was offered, to go to other markets and bigger places, I said, no, it's not any more real there. News isn't any more real in New York or Los Angeles than it is here. And sports isn't any bigger there than it is here. And I'm going to stay here. And I've been very happy that I stayed here. And now nobody asks anymore, so I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, that's good. And that's a really good thing. I was blown away. Like, I had a really good time in Detroit. They had done this thing. It was 4th of July weekend when I went, when the White Sox played against the Tigers. And they had put together like an impromptu roller skating rink downtown.
Right. Yep.
And I had like the time of my life. Like I was trying to explain to people, and I threw it up on Instagram and on Twitter, and I said, what people tell you about Detroit is completely wrong. And yeah. I never felt like there was an organic like feel of joy seeing everyone excited and hanging around and having fun. That's not to say that any city doesn't have problems, but the effort that the people of Detroit have put into Detroit to try and make it, to fight against the stereotype of Detroit, I think has been magnificent.
Yeah. Well, it's a great city, and we have a lot of belief in ourselves. And, it's a kind of place where, I grew up in the East, and in the East, as soon as you got out of high school, you were gone. You went wherever the job was. You got out of college, you went where the job was. Job was in Phoenix, you went to Phoenix. Job was in Seattle, you went to Seattle. And I find in Michigan, people, maybe they go to high school here and they go to college locally, and then they get a job offer in Florida, and they have a big party, and the going away party, and they're going to Florida, and then 6 months later, you see they're back, and you say, well, what happened? I thought you took a job in Florida. Yeah, I miss my family, I miss my friends, and people just want to be, amongst one another here, and I love that, and I feel very at home here.
Does sports still carry, does it still do something for you at this point? You've done so much in your career. Does covering a game still matter to you the way that it used to 20 years ago?
Well, if I'm assigned to go do something, I still write for the Detroit Free Press, not very frequently, but I still do. I take it seriously, because who am I to say, oh, I'm above this or better than this? It's important to the other people who are doing it there, and it should be important to me. But I also have cut back on the way that I write about sports or cover sports dramatically from when I started, which was like 5 columns a week. And, I was going to batting practice and hanging around basketball practice. And, no, I don't do that anymore. There's too many things in the world that, I'm interested in, and I think may benefit from my attention a little bit more, writing about them a little bit more, spending more time. Most of my time now, Lawrence, about 65% of the week is just charitable work. And I have a foundation here in Detroit called Say Detroit, which started after the Super Bowl in 2006 as a very small little idea, and now has grown to a multi-million dollar charity. And we have 9 operations here in Detroit, and I oversee them. And then I have an orphanage in Haiti that I operate in, and there's 53 kids there, and I'm there every single month, sometimes for 2 weeks at a shot. So that eats up a lot of the time. So there's not, but just to say, it's not the same kind of time to just go, hey, I'll go hang around Pistons practice for a while and see if there's a story. But it doesn't mean that sports doesn't matter for when you're paying attention to it. It matters. And when a team is on a roll, it matters. And it's, especially here in Detroit, it can be a big source of civic pride, when a team does well. I've always felt that sports is no less real than all the other news. It's no less real than politics, no less real than business, and it deserves to be covered that way. It's just my interests between the charities and the books are a little bit more diverse.
When you were kind of tapped to do more stuff nationally, How do you think that that changed the way that sports is covered overall? Because it seemed like you guys in the sports reporters group, for example, like that was the birth of what we now have are like debate shows. But it felt like what you guys were doing was a lot more genteel than the way that it's done now.
Well, you're right about that. And there were two shows. There were ours, and there was a thing called the Sports Writers on TV out of Chicago that actually started right about the same time. And it was, writers sitting around and talking about sports. It wasn't people who were trying to make a name for themselves in television. And I don't say that disparagingly, but I do say that in that there's a different set of criteria. If you want to be long-lasting on TV, you need to, like, be a personality. You need to be a screamer. You need to be a guy who waves his arms crazy or wears a shirt rolled up. Or there's got to be something visual about you and audible about you that people remember. Otherwise, you're just another face. We never worried about that because we all had other jobs. And so we weren't trying to become, make our entire careers in television. We just got together on Sunday mornings for a half an hour and spoke the way that we speak to one another. And, we wore suits and ties. That was kind of always the tradition with Dick Schaap. And we just continued it. And I think that kind of helped with the gentility that you're referring to. And we didn't look at it as like, I'm going to make a name for myself by putting the other person down. And now it's been kind of bastardized. That whole idea of healthy debate has become point counterpoint. And, one has to go against the other. And you wonder sometimes if they even necessarily believe the take that they're having, or it's just, well, he took the positive take, so I'm going to take the negative take. So we can have conflict. And sports reporting wasn't about conflict. We were okay with saying, yeah, you're right. I agree with you. But then at other times, if you didn't, you were okay with that, but you didn't have to call the guy and ask, you just said, I disagree with you. And I guess that was an older way of doing things.
Is there a way to get back there? Is there a way to give the consumer an option and amplify what I think can be constructive, whether it's sports radio or sports television, to give them a choice for that and then hope that they make that decision to choose what isn't so bombastic?
Well, I would hope so, but it takes somebody brave and an executive, to roll the dice on that, because if the trend is louder, more explosive, let's find the next louder guy, the more explosive guy, then to say, no, I'm going to go the opposite direction. You're out there on an island, and if it doesn't work, you're going to get fired. And that's what people are afraid of. So they don't take chances. It's the same thing with the movie business, television business. Everybody wants what's already working. And it's the brave person who says, oh, let's try something that's different that hasn't been tried or hasn't worked in a while, but it might be time for. I don't know, Lawrence. I'd love to think that, gentility and respect can be an antidote to the awful, screaming and anger and vitriol that goes on in broadcasting of all kinds, not just sports, look at politics. But something tells me that once we head down that road, it's only going to get nastier and nastier.
Before we get to the book, and I do want to talk about it because I have questions, but I wanted to ask you about the orphanage. You brought it up a little while ago. How do you think your work in Haiti has changed you, and what drew you to Haiti specifically?
Well, the first question, it's changed me in every possible way. My wife and I never had kids of our own. We wanted to, but we got married late. It didn't happen. And we became sort of uncles and aunts to our nieces and nephews. And then all of a sudden, 12 years ago, I found myself in Haiti. That's answering your other question. What drew me to Haiti? I wasn't drawn to Haiti. I was kind of corralled into going to Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. A pastor came to me on a radio program I did and said that he had an orphanage down there, but he thought it had been destroyed and that all the kids had been killed, because he couldn't get phone calls through and he was desperate. And could I help him get down there? So I helped arrange a flight down there 2 weeks after the earthquake, because I knew a senator here in Michigan who was on the Armed Forces Committee. So we were able to get a slot to fly in, and we flew in on a little plane. And what I saw in Haiti after that earthquake will never leave me. I mean, it was hell on earth, or people walking around without arms or legs, and, you know, triage happening right in the middle of the street, and everybody was covered in white dust, and there were rubble, you know, mountains of rubble everywhere, and bodies inside those mountains that you could smell the decay from the bodies, and people were, you know, hand by hand trying to pull rocks out and trying to get at the bodies. And when I got to the orphanage, it hadn't been destroyed, but it had been overrun. And I was just so taken with the kids that I came back again, and I came back and brought people down with me who were builders. And we built the first toilets, we built the first showers, we built the first kitchen, we built the school. And meanwhile, I was doing all this, the kids were still eating one cup of rice a day. And I said to this pastor, I don't get it. You know, we're coming down here every month, and kids aren't getting any better. What's going on? And he admitted to me he didn't have any money to run it, and he was in his mid-80s. And I sort of blurted out, well, I could probably run this. I run some charities in Detroit. And he said, oh, praise Jesus, hallelujah, here it is. And that was pretty much the last we saw of him. And I've been running it ever since. So it kind of found me, but it has been profound. And we have 53 children there now, all but six of whom I admitted. The other six are from the original group that was there. And it's a miraculous place, despite how dangerous Haiti is. And our kids are joyous and loving, and they have no phones, no internet, no computers, no television. And so I get to see what childhood is really like when you don't have all these interferences. And it's a beautiful thing to witness. And I'll spend the rest of my life involved there, and more involved there. And it's the most fortunate thing that's ever happened to me.
It's an amazing story. It really is. And it's wonderful that, yes, like, you're there to try and help people, but it also probably helps you, and it's probably helped give you a better understanding of the world at large, right?
No question. It also, as I get older, children are the only thing that make any sense to me. Adults just make less and less sense, and the silliness that we do as grown-ups is crazy, but the faith of children and the purity of children is inspiring. And you know, anybody who gets older gets weary. You know, it just comes with it. You get tired of silliness or stupidity, and particularly in the sports or journalism world or wherever, where you can kind of go, really, you know, like, this is really what we're talking about now. But when you're down there and you're taking in a child who was left under a tree to die, and someone found him and took him to the police, and the police said, what'd you pick him up for? Now we have to do paperwork. And the woman takes the baby and runs from the police station and runs to us and says, will you take him? You know, a 2-month-old baby. That's important. That's not a tempest in a teapot. That's not whether Aaron Rodgers got vaccinated or not. You know, that matters. You're saving a life. And we've had that happen multiple times with kids who were abandoned, kids whose parents were killed in earthquakes or hurricanes, who were living in a hole in the ground under a piece of tin, who were left in a malnutrition clinic, and nobody came back for them for 2 years. They lived in the hallways of a malnutrition clinic. These are all profiles of some of the kids that we have. And so you really feel like you're doing something that matters. You know, you're changing the child's trajectory in their life. You're giving them food when they didn't have it. You're giving them shelter when they didn't have it. You're giving them love when it doesn't exist. That energizes you. And you don't feel like, why am I wasting my time on this? And so it is a gift. It's really, to me, it's a gift of purpose, and I don't know what could be a greater gift than that.
How big a role did the kids play in helping you put this book together?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Together.
Well, I wrote a lot of it down in Haiti because I spent a lot of time there during the pandemic. And when you have a computer, you know, I'm the only one with a computer, a little laptop. So I'm sitting out at a table. You're going to attract, that's like honey to a bee. You know, all the kids come swarming around. And what are you doing, Mr. Mitch? Well, I'm writing. What are you writing, Mr. Mitch? Well, I'm writing my book. What's the name of the book, Mr. Mitch? The Stranger in the Lifeboat. Who is the stranger in the lifeboat, Mr. Mitch? I was like, okay, why don't you guys just read it? Okay, here. So I printed it out and I gave it to them. And our kids learn English from the time that they, you know, come in, sometimes as young as, you know, 1 year, 2 years old. So they're pretty good readers. And even my 10-year-olds and 11 and 12 and 13, they were all reading the manuscript, and they love books because, you know, they don't have television, they don't have radio, they don't have internet, so book is like they jump into it. And they actually gave me some pretty good ideas, you know, like they had some criticisms and so, you know, I said, okay, well, yeah, that's a fair question. And yeah, maybe I do need to change that. So they were great. And the Today Show, last week I did the Today Show with Hoda Kotb, and they got a hold of some tape down from in Haiti, and they got the kids to review the book. So there were like six of them that gave these reviews. I said, oh God, I hope one of them doesn't like put a thumbs down or something. But they were very kind. They were positive, and it was cute to see them, you know, talking to a camera and saying, good job, Mr. Mitch. So that was the best part of it.
What was the inspiration for this book? Because it is, I was expecting it to be a very dense and deep, and I got that. But I'm curious on what made you write it, because there's a lot here, Mitch.
Yeah. Well, so it's the story of starts with this luxury yacht that all the rich and famous people from around the world are on this week-long cruise, and suddenly it mysteriously explodes, and everybody's killed except 10 people, five of whom are the rich guests on the ship, and five of whom are the staff, like the cooks and the deckhands, and they all get into this life raft and they're floating out in the ocean for 3 days and nobody's coming for them. And they're out of food and water and they see sharks in the ocean and they're desperate for help, crying out. And suddenly they see a body bobbing up and down the waves and they get to it and they pull it into the life raft. And it's this young guy, kind of average looking, nondescript guy. And they pepper him with questions and he doesn't say anything. And finally, one of the passengers says, well, thank the Lord, we found you. And he says, I am the Lord. And it kind of takes off from there, you know, and their reactions to him and what happened days past. And they say, of course, they don't believe him. They think he's some guy who banged his head on a ship or something. And they say, well, yeah, okay, you're the Lord. What are you doing here? And he says, well, haven't you been calling me? I came because you called me. And they say, oh, so what, you're going to save us? And he says, well, I can only save you if everyone in this boat believes I am who I say I am at the same time. And that becomes a sort of challenge as the days go on and things get more desperate and they get hit by waves and sharks and all these crazy things that happen. So are they going to believe their eyes or are they going to believe their hearts? And, you know, the notion for it kind of came over the last 2 years with the pandemic and all the help that we've been asking for. You know, a lot of people have been asking for divine help with a job and not losing their job or not getting sick or someone who has COVID and please don't let them die. And it occurred to me that we, you know, we ask for help all the time, but we expect help to come like we order a deli sandwich. Like, you know, okay, I ordered it and it's better be here in 5 minutes. It better look like what I ordered. And if it isn't, we get upset. But in my life, I've seen that after 5 or 10 years, you look back and you say, well, that time I thought my prayers weren't answered, actually, then if that hadn't happened, then this wouldn't have happened. Then I wouldn't have met this person who I ended up marrying, and then we wouldn't have the kids. And so I guess that was the best thing that could have happened to me. Well, if it's the best thing that could have happened to you 10 years from now, it's the best thing that could have happened to you now. It's just that we don't see it that way. And so I set up this crazy scenario in which people have to recognize, are they getting the help that they need or not? And that's the challenge of the book.
Your descriptions in the book of the loneliness, through Benji, the loneliness that everyone on the boat is feeling through his eyes and through the things that he's writing, I thought was amazing. I felt like I was there with them working through that. And there can be a lot of symbolism with, especially since you wrote it during the pandemic, on how all of us probably feel a little bit detached from right. everything. And the boat can symbolize that, and them being out on the ocean with there being no hope could symbolize that. I was really drawn to that aspect of the book and how you crafted it.
Thank you. Well, you're right. You know, everybody's lonely and everybody's calling out for help. And I try to put, like, I'm sure, Lawrence, if I disappeared from your podcast mysteriously, suddenly, and a new voice came on and said, I'm sorry, Mitch is indisposed, but this is the Lord, Lawrence, and I'm going to give you 60 seconds and you can ask me any question you want. I'm sure you would come up with some pretty good questions very quickly. And I try to come up with those questions and put them in the mouths of the passengers in this desperate situation when, you know, they're running out of food and they're hungry. The sun is baking them and there are sharks coming after their boat. That's when it gets real. You know, that's when you're not asking for, you know, the lottery number to come through for you. You're asking to stay alive. And they pose questions to him that we would ask if we had that opportunity. Like, do you answer prayers? And he says, well, I answer all prayers, but sometimes the answer is no, which is something I have come, a philosophy that I come to believe in. Or there's a moment where one of the passengers in the middle of the night takes his own life. He throws himself overboard because he wants to be with his departed wife, and he just thinks that that's the best thing. And in the morning when they wake up and they see he's gone, everybody gets mad at this Lord character as if he was supposed to do something about it. And one of the passengers says, if you were really God, you would have stopped him. And he says, God starts things, man stops them. And again, if you really think about that, you know, we've been given everything on this earth to create a perfect world if we want it. We have enough food and resources to feed every hungry person. We have enough intelligence to cure every disease. Look at what we did with the vaccine in 1 year. If we focus like that on cancer and put all our efforts into it, we'd have it wiped out. But we don't. We choose more selfish things. We choose to make more money. And we're the ones who invent guns. We're the ones who invent bombs and war. We're the ones who invent cigarettes and alcohol and all the things that stop life and stop progress. And yet we blame God when bad things happen. And so I thought that that was appropriate, you know, or, you know, other questions about why do people die and things like that. And at some point or another, all these things get posed, and they, based on his answers, they try to determine, is this guy for real or is he just some kook? And by the way, I'm not saying that he is or isn't. You know, if you've read the book, you know, there are a lot of twists and turns in it. And, you know, I'm not saying that. A lot of people say, oh, okay, this guy must have long hair and a beard, and he must have an interesting birth story involving a manger. You know, I said, no, he's not Jesus. He's just some guy. You know, he looks like a surfer. You know, he's nothing special. And, you know, it's up to you to decide whether you think he's for real or not.
Is it hard writing dialogue for God?
Well, I joke around that, you know, as you write it, you keep looking up to see, you know, like, just okay, just okay. I don't want a lightning bolt to come blow up my computer, you know. But I try to write less as God than as the people asking the questions. The wisdom that comes out of this guy's mouth is not me. It's based on things that I have learned from people like Maury from Tuesdays with Maury, or like the clergy people that I spent years with in the book I wrote called Have a Little Faith. And it's a combination of that wisdom and my own life's wisdom that, you know, I'm not a kid anymore, and I have had a lot of things happen that I've had to have a philosophical bent on, not the least of which is, you know, my wife and I adopted one of our children from Haiti when she developed a brain tumor at age 5, and we brought her to America, and she never went home, and she lived with us for the next 2 years as we traveled around the world trying to find a cure for her. And they were an amazing 2 years. I mean, loving and wonderful and funny. And since my wife and I had never had children of our own, it was such a blessing. Suddenly we had a 5-year-old sleeping at the foot of our bed, even though we were in our mid-50s, you know. But when she died, you know, I was broken. I mean, and so was my wife. I just couldn't accept that there was anything in the universe good, you know, and it couldn't be a God, because what happened to be a God who was kind that wasn't kind to a 7-year-old. And as time has passed, and now it's been 4.5 years, I've had to sort of adopt a better attitude, and because you can't stay in that anger forever. And that is sort of summed up in a moment where one of the characters on the boat approaches, you know, confronts this God character screaming at him, saying, "Why did you take my wife? Why did my wife have to die? Why did you take my wife?" And the response is, well, when people die on earth, we always say, "Why did God take them?" But maybe a better question would be, "Why did God give them to us? Why? What did we do to deserve their sweetness, their humor, their love, you know, their amazing moments that we had with them?" And this character says, "I know that you cry when your loved ones leave this earth, but I can assure you, they're not crying." And for me, that was written as much for me as it was for anybody else, you know, because that's the philosophy I've had to take, that our little girl, Chica, she's not here, and we cry for her not being here, but she's not crying anymore. And in point of fact, we didn't lose a child. We were given one. You know, we had 2 amazing years with her that we wouldn't have had otherwise if we didn't end up going down to Haiti and getting involved in orphanage and all that. So if you look at it as a gift, as opposed to a loss, it's healing. And maybe, you know, Stranger in a Life Book can be healing to other people as well, if that's what they're dealing with.
I was really struck by your depiction of heaven. And I don't want to give away too much, but I was sitting there going, wow, like, what a beautiful way to really think about what afterlife is like, and all the things that, if you believe in an afterlife, what you might be treated to in an afterlife.
Yeah, I don't really want to give away
right.
what it is, like you said, but there's a moment where, to try to heal Benji, who's kind of the central character who's writing in the notebook about what happened here, the Lord character gives him a little glimpse of heaven, you know, opens up the skies up in the middle of the ocean. And I had in my mind, you know, this visual of, okay, you're on a life raft. The sky never looks as big as it does when you're out in the middle of the ocean. I mean, you know, it's just all around you. And you're there, and there's a moon, and there's other gazillion stars, and suddenly all of that disappears, like a curtain being pulled back, and you can actually take a look into heaven. And he gets this opportunity, and it heals him, you know. And the person reading the notebook a year later, who finds it when this life raft washes up on shore empty and there's nobody in it, but there's a notebook hidden in a pouch, he also is affected by reading it. And in that way, you know, one story affects somebody else's story, as a book affects somebody else's life. And as, you know, the stories that I have encountered from other people have affected my story. And so that's why I kind of did it that way. And I don't want to say any more, because
right.
like I say, it kind of takes away from it, but thank you for recognizing that moment in the book.
Well, Mitch, this was a real treat, man. I've loved your work for a long time. I've told you that before. I devoured this book. Like, I did it in 2 sittings. I tried to get it done before the game started on Sunday, and I couldn't. And then I came home from doing my show and knocked out the rest of it, and I was absolutely blown away. The name of the book is The Stranger in the Lifeboat. and you need to pick it up, because I think that no matter where you are on your spectrum of faith, and this is something that I struggle with, I think that there are things that you can take away from it and gain from it. And to me, like, that's the highest compliment that I can give it, that there is something in it for anyone wherever they are on their journey of faith.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. That's really kind. And thank you for reading it. You know, not everybody who hosts a program does. And it certainly makes the conversation better. And I really appreciate the kind words and the generosity of your time. And come on back and join us on the Sports Reporter sometime. You know, we're still doing it twice a week, and we'd love to have you back in the circle.
Well, I appreciate that wholeheartedly, and thanks for this book and continued success with what you're doing in Haiti. And I am a fan and a supporter of what you're doing in Detroit. I try to sing its praises whenever I can. I try to tell people, hey, Bears-Lions game, you should go up to Detroit. Have yourself a good time. You should go and watch the White Sox play in Detroit. And I actually think Detroit's going to be pretty good in a couple of years because they hired the right manager. But
Well, for now, anybody who comes from Chicago for pretty much any of our teams can not only have a great time in Detroit, but they have a pretty good chance of going home happy because our teams are really down right now. So another reason to visit Detroit if you're a Chicagoan, because you'll probably get to see your hometown win.
Mitch, if you ever need anything from me, feel free to reach out. Thanks again for being on the podcast.
Great to talk to you. Be well.
So, yeah, the whole thing's amazing. His whole life, his whole career. I love hearing him talk about Detroit. And I made mention of it inside the interview. He talks about Detroit the way I talk about Chicago. And I like that he has, we can use the word privilege. He has the word privilege. He has privilege to not be in Detroit if he doesn't want to be. He can do what he does from wherever it is that he is. But he made a conscious choice to want to stay and help in Detroit and want to stay and help in Haiti. And I think those are all things that should be applauded and modeled. To be quite honest with you, those are things to be modeled. I love what he said, too, about where we're going as far as sports journalism goes and what are the pitfalls of the relationships that entities have with leagues and teams. And these are all things that I talk about occasionally on the show where I worry about whether or not we are going to be able to talk in real critical terms about things that we care about in the next 5 to 10 years. The mission creep of independent, and I'm using air quotes, you can't see me, independent media, I think is really, really dangerous. And this book, I think he did such a great job of like walking the line of explaining what the book was about without giving away too much. But as I said in the intro, I'm not a very fast reader. I'm someone who likes to, I'm big on reading comprehension. Like, even when I was a little kid, like, that was what the report said about me. I read slow, but I understood everything that I read. And I read this in one day. And I think that you probably could too. I mean, I know people who can read a lot faster than I can. And I think that you will enjoy this and read it in one day. Wherever you get your books, I'm a big proponent of help your local bookstore if you can. If you can't, because I imagine that this book is everywhere. Like, this is not just, this is not niche. Like, this is Mitch Album. So The Stranger in the Lifeboat is probably in a bunch of different places. So go to your local bookstore and support them, or go to the local bookstore and say, hey, do you have the book? Because I would like the book. And go check it out. But I also think that when you hear Mitch talk about these callings that he has and the way that he clearly worked through some of the pain of losing his daughter through writing this book, I find it to be very encouraging. Times are hard right now on so many levels. I talk about the hope bucket a lot. The hope bucket, it doesn't take a ton to refill a hope bucket. Most of us are predisposed to wanting to be positive. Nikki Giovanni is one of my favorite authors. Honestly, one of my favorite people. And she talks about that. She talks a lot about hope. She talks about optimism. Optimism as rebellion. Like, she talks about it a lot. And I love that. It's been something that I've held as kind of a life motto. Optimism is a form of rebellion. I saw her say that at a poetry reading in Chicago, and I've never forgotten it. And I think that if you add the faith element to it, and that's what Mitch is writing about in this book, I think that whatever level of faith that you're at, I struggle with it. I struggle with, like, the people in the book. You'll see. I don't want to give it away, but I saw a lot of myself in characters in the book because of their struggles with faith. But I walked away being wowed by this book and its myriad messages that it has. So I highly recommend it, and I really hope that you enjoyed the conversation that I had with Mitch. I know that I did. It was a lot of fun, and I'm glad that he had time. And hopefully I'll get an opportunity to, like, I feel like that's someone that I should probably talk to more. Hopefully I'll get an opportunity to do that and bounce some questions about all sorts of things off of him, you know, when he has time. You know, when he's not writing award-winning books or running an orphanage in Haiti or doing his best to try and help out in Detroit. You know, when he's not that busy. I thank you so much for listening to this interview and this episode. We got some great episodes coming up. I'm kind of on a roll. I'm feeling great about some of the choices I've made in who to talk to lately. And I think that you're going to benefit from listening to them. Make sure you check out the Sports Adjacent podcast. Those guys are hilarious, man. They're so funny. New episodes of that come out Wednesday nights, Thursday morning. So make sure you check it out and support them. Please subscribe. If you're new to this episode, subscribe and look through the catalog. We get a lot of great guests on House of L, and we keep growing, and we thank you. You had another 70,000 download month, which is phenomenal. Thanks again for your support. I will talk to you next time. Peace.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.